We are rapidly approaching the 10th anniversary of the 1972 presidential election in which the state of Massachusetts, in which we are this evening, had the good sense to vote for our guest, George McGovern. George McGovern was born in Avon, South Dakota on July 19, 1922, the son of a Methodist clergyman. Before earning his doctorate in history, he flew 35 missions as a B-24 bomber pilot in Europe in World War II and was decorated with the Distinguished Flying Cross. He returned to South Dakota to teach college, became executive secretary of the South Dakota Democratic Party in 1953, and was elected to the United States House of Representatives in 1956 and again in 1958. In 1960, President John Kennedy appointed him first director of the U.S. Food for Peace Program and special assistant to the president. He was elected to the United States Senate in 1962 and was reelected in 1968 and 1974. In 1969, he was named chairman of the Democratic Commission on Party Structure and Delegate Selection. In April of 1970, the commission laid down guidelines to ensure more open and representative delegate selection procedures. 2 years later, in 1972, Senator McGovern was the Democratic nominee for president. And as we note in your program guide this evening, in that campaign, he embodied the hopes and fears of millions of Americans who shared his deep reservations about our country's military involvement in Vietnam. If his presidential campaign failed, the peace movement, which he came so powerfully to symbolize, did not. In 1976, Mr. McGovern was appointed by President Gerald Ford as Senate delegate to the 31st session of the General Assembly of the United Nations and was subsequently appointed by President Carter as delegate, again from the Senate, to the UN for the special session on disarmament, which I believe will be part of his subject this evening. During his tenure as Senator, George McGovern was chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs. He was a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and chairman of its Subcommittee on African Affairs. He was also a member of the Joint Economic Committee of the Senate. He's the author of 6 books: War Against Want, Agricultural Thought in the 20th Century, A Time of War, A Time of Peace, The Great Coldfield War, An American Journey, and Grassroots. He has written many articles for leading magazines and journals, holds numerous honorary degrees, has taught at Northwestern, at Columbia University, and at the University of Pennsylvania. Mr. McGovern currently is chairman of Americans for Common Sense, a public interest group which has for its purpose building a counterforce to the right-wing single-issue groups that have surfaced in American politics and encouraging the development of more practical answers to the general, to the great central issues that face the United States in domestic and foreign policy. It's a great pleasure to introduce a great American, I think, George McGovern, and probably the most unusual bomber pilot ever to come out of the United States.
Thank you very much, Michael, members and guests of the Harvard Law School Forum. This is a good place to be, as far as I'm concerned, with an election approaching on next Tuesday. I've been under the strong impression for the last 10 years that there's a special political wisdom here in Massachusetts that is available only in the District of Columbia, but nowhere else in the United States. What I would like to do tonight is just speak very briefly about American foreign policy and then throw it open to questions from the floor, either on that subject or whatever you want to interrogate me about. I'm going to speak in the role of a critic tonight, which may not entirely surprise you. It's a rather commendable role for a patriotic citizen, if for no other reason than the critic always operates from the premise that the country can do better than it's now doing. And that takes a certain faith in the institutions and the leadership and indeed the citizenry of a country to hold over a long period of time that notwithstanding certain disappointments, we are capable of doing better. And that's what I believe about American foreign policy tonight. But before I criticize, let me begin by generally endorsing one aspect of the Reagan foreign policy, and that is the approach they've taken in recent weeks to the events in Lebanon and in the Middle East, and generally the recommendations they have made with regard to a Palestinian settlement. I think, first of all, the president was fully justified in reacting with some measure of moral and political outrage to the overkill bombing of Beirut, the rather bloody foray into Lebanon, and to the subsequent murder by the Falangists in Lebanon of the unarmed families in the refugee camps. Considering the arrogance and contempt displayed by Prime Minister Begin and General Sharon towards the American president and toward world opinion as a whole, I would have to say that the president reacted with measured indignation. And his proposed formula for settlement of the Palestinian issue, I think, is a rather carefully balanced, pragmatic compromise that addresses the central needs of the Israelis, of the Palestinians, and of the Arab states. It really is a logical extension of the Camp David framework that was worked out by Prime Minister Begin, the late President Sadat, and former President Carter. Mr. Reagan's proposal, as I think you know, has won the support of the Israeli opposition leader, Shimon Peres, as well as many of the strongest friends of Israel in this country, of which I consider myself to be one, and also strong support across Western Europe, and I think in the United States as a whole. Now, if, as I suspect, the Secretary of State, George Shultz, is a moving force behind these initiatives of the presidents in the Middle East, then I think we're rather fortunate to have Mr. Shultz as Secretary of State at this time. It was frankly embarrassing to me as a Democrat when last June my fellow Democrats assembled at the midterm convention in Philadelphia, endorsed a resolution praising General Sharon's foray into Lebanon as the best way to reduce terrorism in the Middle East. I think that resolution was a disservice to the Democratic Party, and I think it was an insult to the lofty moral traditions of the Jewish nation. Democrats can help restore their reputation for fairness and common sense if they will replace that kind of political opportunism with strong backing of the president's initiatives for peace and justice in the Middle East. Well, that's enough compliments for the Reagan administration. Now to the more critical part. I might add that some of the disagreements I'm going to express here extend back to previous administrations. They're not confined to the Reagan administration alone in all cases. First of all, I object to the simplistic notions that the Russians are solely responsible for the world's trouble spots, and the corollary of that notion that anti-communism should be the controlling compass of American foreign policy. Shortly before taking over the White House, just a few days in fact, Mr. Reagan gave an exclusive interview to the Wall Street Journal, and this is what he said. Let us not delude ourselves. The Soviet Union underlies all of the unrest that is going on. If they weren't engaged in this game of dominoes, there wouldn't be any hot spots in the world. End of quote. Now, former Secretary Haig put the same premise in slightly different words with reference to Central America when he said that the Sandinista revolution in Nicaragua, which toppled the late President Somoza, and the struggle in El Salvador were simply the first scores on the Soviet hit list for Central America. The assumption being that there wouldn't be any particular problem in Nicaragua or El Salvador or elsewhere in Central America if it weren't for the evil operations of the Soviet Union in our backyard. Now, no one, I suppose, will doubt that the Soviets are capable of a certain amount of mischief. But I think it's simplistic and dangerous to see them as the central force behind the turbulence that we know exists across the developing world. The Soviets did not topple General Somoza in Nicaragua. The long-suffering people of that country did amen. And thank God that the human spirit cannot be oppressed forever. But why give the Russians credit for the liberation of Nicaragua from a hateful, torturous figure like Somoza? Nor does Moscow deserve the credit for the rebellion in El Salvador. The misrule, the economic and social exploitation by the ruling oligarchy of El Salvador have left the citizens of that country no other course other than rebellion. One would have hoped that it might have come in a less bloody way, but I have no doubt at all if most of you had had 10 years as a citizen in El Salvador at your age, you'd probably be in rebellion against the government. Even if Karl Marx and Lenin and Brezhnev had never lived, there would still be revolution and trouble in the developing world. Some of these movements may indeed have a Marxist orientation. But be that as it may, the tendency to surrender American foreign policy to anti-communism as the guiding spirit is not a reliable response. That was the kind of response that carried us into the Vietnam disaster 25 years ago. After 1945, acting on the assumption that Ho Chi Minh was an agent of Peking, or an agent of Moscow, if you will, we fought a long and losing war in Southeast Asia. Thankfully, we have not always been so blind to the possibilities for a more practical and a flexible approach to communist government. Sometimes we have understood that there are Marxist regimes with which we can deal. We've also understood at times that there are some non-Marxist regimes with which we can't deal very dependably. In Yugoslavia, for example, notwithstanding the communist faith of Marshal Tito, and so far as I know, he was every bit as dedicated a communist as Ho Chi Minh, we were able to develop a working relationship with the Yugoslavian government, and in doing so, to encourage some measure of independence from Moscow. A similar opportunity was probably open to us with Ho Chi Minh after the Second World War. Did you ever look at the Declaration of Independence that Ho Chi Minh wrote for the what he hoped would be an independent state at the end of World War II? Well, it reads, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal. That's about the only word he changed, was to change men to people. That all people are created equal. That they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I don't know how sincere he was about those expressions, but I do know that he, in phrasing them, was pleading for American support against the French effort to restore their colonial hold in that part of the globe. But instead of supporting the failing French effort to smash this independence movement led by Ho Chi Minh in the early, or in the late 1940s and the early 1950s, I think we should have explored the possibilities of coming to terms with Vietnamese nationalism, with their efforts to break away from French colonialism, because there is little evidence, either in Vietnamese history or in contemporary realities, that Ho Chi Minh was in fact an agent of Peking, or of Moscow, or of anyone else. Nor is there compelling evidence that the Soviets or the Chinese, or both of them together, are the controlling factors tonight in Angola, or in Central America, or even necessarily in Cuba. I sometimes wonder why our policymakers are so obsessed with these little communist countries. We've worked out a kind of a reasonable relationship with the Russians and the Chinese. We treat them as trading partners. Sometimes we temporarily interrupt that, but by and large, we maintain our embassies in Peking and Moscow, even talking now about a certain amount of military aid to communist China. As far as I know, their communist credentials in China and the Soviet Union are still fairly strong. But somehow these communist giants that have the capacity to destroy us, we've worked out a kind of an arrangement with them. I think that's all well and good. But why this enormous fear and loathing of the little communist countries? Why so much more fear about Angola or Mozambique, or Vietnam, or even Cuba? In the case of Nicaragua, the Reagan administration actually cut off all American grain shipments, a total food boycott against the Sandinista government on the grounds that this government had moved too close to Moscow. But what did we do with Moscow? We lifted the grain embargo. It's all right to sell wheat to Moscow, but don't sell it to anybody that gets close to them. And the irony of all of that is that after putting an embargo on Nicaragua because they were too close to the Russians, and then lifting the embargo on the Russians turned around and gave the Nicaraguans 20,000 tons of grain to make up for the American boycott. So I suppose to whatever extent the shipment of food increases your political influence, the Russians are the gainers rather than American foreign policy. I think it would require a complicated and uncertain psychological review to explain the hard line that we pursue toward these small communist states in contrast to our general tolerance of Moscow and Peking. No less mystifying are our friendly relations with the communist regimes of Eastern Europe, including Poland, the ones that really don't have much chance of breaking out of Soviet domination because they're so close. Compared with our sullen hostility to Cuba, Vietnam, and Angola, and others that are far enough away from the Soviet Union so that with some help from us, they might actually gain a measure of independence. But my central concern tonight is with the Reagan administration, is its misguided and dangerous policy towards the Soviet Union itself. It is well to appreciate the Soviet danger. Indeed, as we know, they're capable, if they wish, of destroying us. They'll destroy themselves in the process, but they are capable of eliminating the United States in a nuclear exchange, just as they would surely disappear themselves. But it's dangerous to follow false premises about the Soviet Union, or to exaggerate certain aspects of that threat to the neglect of other challenges to American security and American interests. Let me just illustrate here quickly what I'm talking about. In 1955, just shortly before I first went to the Congress, the Soviets revealed their first strategic bomber. It was called the Bison. At that time, the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force, warned the Congress that within 2 years, according to the information they had and their projections, the Soviets would have built such a huge fleet of these intercontinental bombers that they would have the capacity to successfully execute a knockout strike against the United States. This was widely heralded as the bomber gap. The report of the new Soviet bomber literally produced a panic at the Pentagon, I must say, among certain members of the Congress, which led to a great urgent acceleration of U.S. bomber production. Now, later on, we were to learn that the Soviets had only 10 of these Bison bombers, and that the bomber gap that was supposed to reach its most critical level in 1957 was, in fact, a bomber gap, but it was 5-1 in our favor. We had 5 bombers capable of hitting the Soviet Union for every one that they had capable of hitting the United States. Likewise, when in that same year, 1957, 2 years after the bomber gap was first revealed, when the Soviets tested their first space vehicle, the celebrated Sputnik, the CIA predicted in that fall that the Soviets would go into all-out missile production that would put the United States in a position of grave danger. So this was born as the missile gap. Most people here are too young to remember the missile gap, but it was even more feared than the bomber gap. And in 1959, 2 years after the Sputnik was launched, the Gaither Commission soberly warned the nation that we were in deadly peril from the overwhelming missile superiority of the Russians. One member of the Gaither Commission, an anonymous release, was quoted on the front page of the Washington Post as saying that Soviet missile supremacy is so preponderant that I feel as though I have looked straight into hell. Senator John Kennedy, for whom I had great personal affection, made the highly feared missile gap a central feature of the 1960 presidential campaign. And yet in his last State of the Union address in early 1960, President Eisenhower said this: "The bomber gap of several years ago was a total fiction, and the missile gap shows every sign of being the same." End of quote. Now, President Eisenhower was, of course, right, both about the fictitious bomber gap and the fictitious missile gap. There were gaps, of course, but they were overwhelmingly in our favor, both in the case of bombers and missiles. Little wonder that President Eisenhower devoted his farewell address to that celebrated phrase warning the American people against the unwarranted power of the military-industrial complex. Now, this has not prevented President Reagan from inventing his own gap, the window of vulnerability. Acting on this and other fictions designed to scare the Congress and the American people, maybe I should qualify that, maybe he really believes it. He has launched an extravagant military spending spree that can only dissipate the strength of the American economy, needlessly burden the taxpayers, pile up an unprecedented annual deficit, which will probably hit $150 billion annually in this current fiscal year, weaken our commitment to important domestic programs, including one that many people in this room are interested in, the program of student loans and student aid, and worst of all, undercut the hopes for arms control and international security. Meanwhile, the SALT II treaty lies moldering in the United States Senate, the victim of domestic American politics, not the realities of the world, but a victim of domestic American politics of the kind played by Mr. Reagan as a foe of the SALT Treaty during the Ford administration, at a time when he was running against Mr. Ford for the nomination, and then later against the Carter administration. I noticed Phyllis Schlafly was quoted the other day as saying she was against SALT II, and she was also against the nuclear freeze. She said that instead of being for a nuclear freeze, the American people ought to thank God that he has given us the nuclear bomb. If in fact he has, I wish he hadn't have given so many to the Russians. But the window of vulnerability that Mr. Reagan imagines is based on the premise that land-based missiles will become vulnerable to attack in the mid-1980s and thus will tempt the Soviets to launch a nuclear war. It's just taken for granted, not only by Mr. Reagan, but apparently by a great many other Americans, that this is Russian policy, that they're lusting to launch a nuclear war against the United States, that this is what their objective is, notwithstanding the fact they would surely be annihilated in the process. But if, in fact, land-based missiles are becoming vulnerable to attack, it is the Soviet Union that has the window of vulnerability, not the United States. Why is that? For the simple reason that 75% of the entire Soviet missile force is on the land, whereas only 25% of the U.S. missile force is on the land, and the rest are on submarines and bombers. So instead of this panic, the window of vulnerability about land-based missiles, we ought to congratulate ourselves that our strategic planners had the foresight 20 or 25 years ago to diversify the basing of the U.S. missile system and to put most of them on submarines. One of those submarines. Let's suppose that the Russians hit us tomorrow and every land-based missile disappears. 75% of our missiles are still intact on submarines and bombers. And one of those submarines, just one, has enough destructive power to eliminate every major city in the Soviet Union. So this concept of the window of vulnerability, in my judgment, is as fictitious as the bomber gap and the missile gap of earlier eras. Now, not content with this obvious deterrent capability, and I say obvious deterrent capability, because everyone who has followed this knows that years ago, the Soviet Union achieved the capability of absorbing a first strike from the United States and still utterly destroying us in retaliation. And we've had that same capability for a much longer time. There's no question about that. No matter which one hits first, they have little advantage in view of the capacity of offensive nuclear weapons to overwhelm the defense. But not content with that, the Reagan administration has set out on what I believe to be the most costly and foolish of all of their mistakes, and that is a huge military buildup on the dangerous premise that it might just be possible to fight and win a limited nuclear war. This notion that with enough nuclear arms we can win a nuclear war is by far the most ignorant and dangerous of all the Reagan policies. Let me just say this. The whole concept of limited nuclear war is based on the premise that two countries that don't have enough sanity and restraint to avoid a nuclear war would suddenly become very restrained and very cautious and careful once they start exchanging these nuclear weapons. In other words, in a limited war, I suppose Boston might disappear, and our president would say, well, we want to be careful about this. We'll just take out Leningrad. And then the Russians say, well, that's fair enough. We don't want to get too panicky. This is supposed to be a limited war. So they take out New York. And then the president says, well, that probably calls for Moscow to go. And these two men sit there in their surgical procedures, eliminating one city after another. And you finally say, well, the time has come for one side to surrender. We've only lost 40 or 50 million on our side, and they've lost 60 or 70 million, that they should know enough at this point to quit knocking off American cities. In any event, so much for the limited war concept. I agree with Dr. George Kistiakowsky, the science advisor for President Eisenhower and then later for President Kennedy and President Johnson, that once these missiles start flying, there's not going to be any limited war. There's going to be a catastrophe and annihilation. Now, that race to supremacy, and I freely admit it's going on in the Soviet Union with all the zeal that it's being pursued here, is all the more dangerous in that it is accompanied by the substitution of confrontation in our foreign policy for the policy of détente that was constructed during the Nixon-Kissinger era. Mr. Nixon believed that notwithstanding our differences with the Soviet Union, that we could cooperate in areas of common interest, such as arms control or commercial trade. Thus, the Nixon-Kissinger administration successfully executed the SALT I Treaty. And the remarkable political part about that is that they did it right in the middle of the Vietnam War. Notwithstanding the fact that American bombs were falling on Haiphong Harbor with Soviet ships in the harbor, and Soviet arms were flowing to Vietnam to kill American soldiers, still, the Soviet and the American leaders got together and negotiated the SALT I Treaty, I suppose on the premise that the survival of the world was even more important than our differences in Vietnam. Now, it's not easy for me as a Democrat to recognize what I believe to be a fact, and that is that President Nixon had the most intelligent policy toward the superpowers, Russia and China, of any president since World War II. and President Eisenhower had the most realistic national defense and national security policy of any president since World War II. I don't expect Ronald Reagan to follow the advice of George McGovern, but I would rest more easily if we could persuade him to follow the example of two of his Republican predecessors, Eisenhower on defense and Nixon on detente. Instead of launching a wholly unjustified military spending binge that at best will devour $1.5 trillion in the next few years. If anybody knows what $1.5 trillion is, you can comprehend something I can't, other than it's mind-boggling. At the very least, it'll consume dollars at that level, and at worst, increase the danger of nuclear annihilation. Instead of that, the Reagan administration should seize on the most urgent challenge of our age, and that is arms negotiations designed to halt and then to drastically cut the huge arms outlays of the Soviet Union and the United States. The time is now to halt this arms race so we have some chance to save the human race. Reversing the arms race by means of a practical and verifiable settlement along the lines of the SALT II Treaty is the foreign policy challenge number one. And on that transcendent issue, the Reagan administration, at the end of 4.5 innings, has no hits, no runs, and so many errors that I can't enumerate them all here tonight. Thank you very much.
We'd like to throw it open to questions now, and please try to use these microphones. We're being taped for a radio broadcast, and we'd appreciate it if you could just come up and line up. It'll be very systematic, and we have two aisles with mics. Thank you.
Why do you think it is that the Reagan administration is inventing the window of vulnerability?
Well, I think that President Reagan takes a very simplistic approach on that issue, that he frankly has been brainwashed by people who feel that the only way to approach the Soviet Union is with an overwhelming preponderance of military power. He's under the notion that it's not even really safe to negotiate with them until we're well out in front on the military side. It's a little hard for me to believe that the president doesn't grasp the fact that even if the land-based missiles are vulnerable, that places the Soviet Union in a more dangerous position than it does us, for the reasons I cited here earlier. But I think he's bought the notion that the Russians are so dangerous and so irascible that you shouldn't even sit down at the conference table with them until you have a strong lead militarily. To me, that's a hopeless goal. It's very difficult for me to imagine either side letting the other one achieve a clear superiority. I think as matters now stand, most of our military people believe that there's a rough parity between the Soviet Union and the United States, and that's probably the best conditions to hope for in terms of negotiations, when each side feels reasonably confident of their equality with the other side. If we had all of the Joint Chiefs here tonight, it would be interesting to ask them if they would trade the American strategic system for the Soviet system. If you can ever find a really responsible general or admiral who will tell you that, I'd like to meet him. Would we trade the American Air Force tonight for the Soviet Air Force? Would we trade our Navy for theirs, including the basing structure that we have all around the world. About the only place where they have the edge on us is in the numbers of soldiers, infantry soldiers on the ground. But keep in mind that 40% of those are positioned against China, not against us. We don't have a China on our border to worry about. We're very fortunate in terms of geography and that we've got an ocean on the east, an ocean on the west, the Canadian Mounted Police on the north, and the Mexicans on the south. It probably could be handled by the Louisiana National Guard. So we don't, I don't say that in any derogatory sense. I admire the Mexicans for not wasting all their money on armies. It's just a fact of life that they don't have a big army. Nothing to fear from Mexico in the way of military power. So I don't know why the hiss was mounted, but I hope no one takes it as a secret racist remark on my part.
Thank you. Senator, I'd like to propose a trade. I'd like to propose sending President Reagan into retirement and sending you to the White House, where you seem to so richly deserve to be.
I accept.
Well, I hope you think about that, seriously.
Well, believe me, if I thought I could be nominated and elected, I'd announce tonight.
You were such an underdog in 72 when you got nominated. Why not try it again?
Well, I think that with regard to that matter, and I ask about it all the time, I'm not going to be coy about it, that it'd be very difficult for me to successfully mount another presidential effort. But if I thought I could do it, even if I thought I might lose and make a real difference in the understanding, the public understanding of the issues before the country, I might try it. If I could help define what I think are the basic economic problems, some of the mistaken priorities that we're now pursuing, some of the mistakes in foreign policy and defense policy, and could make those ideas effective in the way I presented them, I would seriously consider another run. I haven't checked this with Ted yet, but it's obviously, if you run for president once, you never entirely get that interest out of your system. I've so far resisted it in 76 and 1980, but I don't have a job now. I'm getting tired of living on welfare and food stamps. So it's possible that as we move towards 84, that conditions will develop in a way that might make sense for me to try it again. I haven't ruled it out. Thank you.
Senator, you speak of negotiation to halt arms production and eventually reduction. How would you feel about unilateral measures to reduce arms? Or put another way, do you really believe in the theory of mutual nuclear deterrence?
I don't think you really have to go the unilateral route. I think, first of all, it's politically unacceptable to the American public.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean you're wrong.
No, I agree. I'm not saying it does, but it makes it impossible. And I don't think you have to go that route. I think it's possible to go the mutual route. You know, it's a matter of some embarrassment to me as a longtime member of the United States Senate that the SALT II treaty did not die in the Kremlin. It died in the United States Senate, or at least it's asleep in the United States Senate. And the reason that the SALT II treaty was not ratified had nothing to do with military realities. It had everything to do with domestic politics here in the United States, the fear on the part of senators and President Ford and eventually President Carter that we couldn't safely press for ratification of that treaty, given the poison that had been distributed to the American people on arms control. I think the Soviets very badly want that treaty, not because they're saints, but because they're hard-boiled realists who understand that you can't forever pour all of your substance into the arms race. This is even harder on them than it is us. Anybody that's been to the Soviet Union.
I can understand President Reagan in your phraseology being brainwashed, but how is it that he maintains such support in Congress for his program?
Well, for one thing, there's not a clear and appealing Democratic alternative being spelled out day after day. People don't see an exciting, challenging alternative agenda. I think the Democrats are kind of slowly stumbling towards one, and may have one by 84. But we're not used to being out of power. We're used to the day-to-day business of governing, where you improvise here and make a deal here and quiet this interest group there and reward this one, sort of improvising. We haven't been out of power in a position where we had to devise a long-term alternative strategy. And furthermore, we haven't dealt for a long time against such an appealing communicator as President Reagan. He's very good on television, which is the name of the game in politics. And when you look at what the Democrats are offered, they're really handicapped in trying to answer these powerful television appeals. The president can sit down and give a fireside chat anytime he wants to, or call a press conferences and preempt all of the networks. It's very tough to turn that around. Now, the other side of that is that the public opinion pollsters tell us that President Reagan is lower in public approval today than either Ford or Carter as they came to the end of their first 2 years in the White House. So who knows where he'll be by 1984.
Senator, you spoke earlier about tendency for United States foreign policy to actually involve itself more seriously in third world countries. Rather, they talk about the Soviet threat, but they really do something in third world countries. Do you feel that now that we're finally having a long overdue national debate on disarmament, that the fact that it has been, the discourse has been cast in terms of nuclear arms rather than the entire military spectrum that's available, that that's a problem in making the connection to the threat of intervention in countries like Nicaragua, El Salvador, Angola, Mozambique, the Persian Gulf?
This is a good question, I think, that the nuclear arms are so much more glamorous and gripping that it's easy to forget about the worldwide arms race that's going on in conventional weapons, especially in the third world, where countries that really can't afford it are allocating increasing amounts of their budget to the acquisition of tanks and airplanes and ships and artillery, modern weapons of war. The arms bill, the last I saw worldwide, even before this recent Reagan buildup, the global arms budget had exceeded $600 billion. That's a lot of money. It's also very dangerous to ship arms, which we're doing and the Soviets are doing to a certain extent, into these volatile third world situations where there's still a lot of instability and turbulence and rivalry across borders, sometimes rivalry within the countries. And I think your question's well put, that we don't look at that very much. We don't even look at the nuclear proliferation issue very much. We're so fixed on the Soviet-American race that we forget there's going to be a dozen members of the nuclear club out there in a few years. So I think both the conventional arms buildup, especially in the third world that you refer to, and the tendency to try to win the support of third world countries by shipping them arms, plus the nuclear proliferation issue, are ones that we ought to look at more carefully than we have.
Do you have enough sense of confidence in the possibility of a truly rational discussion of the real true issues that are facing us in the context of the kind of political campaigns, the way they're waged in this country, that those kinds of issues can be talked about? Would you be afraid to talk like this if you were actually running for president to talk about those kinds of connections? Or
I wouldn't be afraid to do it, but that doesn't mean I would prevail. I thought I talked pretty bluntly 10 years ago. And I think that's how I won the Democratic nomination. But I also think it had a lot to do with alienating the so-called silent majority that Mr. Nixon talks so much about. There really was a silent majority. We had the we had the biggest rallies at those, I'm talking about the presidential rallies after I was nominated, the biggest crowds ever drawn by a presidential contender. It looked great on the surface. Somebody referred to 100,000 here in Boston. At one point, we had a rally in Post Office Square that the late Speaker McCormick told me was the biggest political rally he'd ever seen in the history of Massachusetts. So we had the people out there. They were excited by this kind of talk. But unfortunately, the people who weren't excited by it were laying back there in the woods waiting for us on election day, and they didn't necessarily know how to articulate their views, but they knew what they thought, and they didn't want all these radicals running the country as they perceived us. I've never thought I was all that radical, but that's the way it was perceived when you come out four square for withdrawal from Vietnam and a $30 billion cut in the military budget and equal rights for women, all those radical things. It scares a lot of people, but I think it's important to talk in those kind of frank terms. If I could just take another minute on this, I am worried about what's happening in American politics, the way these little 30-second spots have taken over, the paid commercial. What I think is happening more and more is that a candidate will raise, let us say, $500,000 to run for Congress, or $1 million to run for the Senate, and they allocate about 80% of it to television. But first they get hold of a professional pollster, and that pollster tells them what will sell, and even how to phrase it. And after you find out what's popular, then you go to a public relations firm, and they develop these slick little commercials, you know, vote for Joe, he's for you, and vote for Ronnie and get the Russians off your, get the Uncle Sam off your back, or vote for a strong America, all that kind of stuff. It really doesn't shed much light on the issues, but it gets people kind of titillated about some attractive candidate who's made to look on television through these producers like a kind of a combination of Jefferson and Lincoln and St. Paul, and so the voters sit out there and wonder what this is all about. You know, I like this guy, he's got a nice smile, and this fella's got a good family, and somebody else is a good communicator. And you get all these slogans and slick media treatments. I'm not against television. I think it's a great opportunity for education, but I think we're misusing it in politics to the point where, instead of giving us a better understanding of the issues, it enables candidates to sell themselves pretty much like you would a bottle of Coke.
Yeah, you would have predicted the first real wave of those PAC smear campaigns couple of years back, and I think that's one of the biggest pities in American politics.
Thank you.
What do you think some of the important elements of a Democratic alternative agenda on defense policy might look like? And in particular, how do you think the Democrats should respond to the fact that we're facing a whole new generation of nuclear weapons, including the Cruise and the Trident and the MX, that will really put the nuclear arms race on a hair trigger?
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. The great danger is that if the Soviets and the Americans continue to build, if we go ahead with the MX and they decorate each one of those SS-18s with 40 warheads that are independently targeted, and both sides are building bigger and more deadly submarine missile launchers, and now the both sides are exploring the possibility of warfare in outer space, knocking out each other's satellites, which is what we depend on to verify arms control agreements. I get very discouraged about what the situation is going to be 10 years down the road. I would say this, that if we don't reverse the course we're on now, when I say we, I mean the Russians and the Americans primarily, if they stay on this present acceleration, without any significant arms control breakthroughs in the next 5 or 6 years, I think arms control is out the window. And if we stay on that course for another 10 years, I think there'll be a nuclear war between the two sides, either by accident or design. One of the reasons I think that is that it's possible, if you continue to pile on more and more on both sides, for one side or the other or both to come to the conclusion that the other side has a first strike capability. You look, you begin to count all the things they could throw, and you think, my God, if they go first, we won't have the capacity even to retaliate. It'd be even more dangerous if the Russians thought that, that if we went first, they wouldn't have the possibility to retaliate. Because if you think you don't have the possibility to retaliate, and the other side does, you want to make damn sure you go first. And I think that's the hair trigger you're talking about, that if this offensive capability, which is already enormous, gets to a first strike capability on either side, I think we're in deadly danger of somebody panicking and trying to be first. So the Democrats ought to come out clearly for an immediate halt on any further accumulation of nuclear weapons, and then a series of agreements to negotiate downward the existing stockpiles of nuclear weapons.
Senator, something that deeply concerns me is Nicaragua. Our dear president, when on the subject of Honduras and Nicaragua, refuses to say what aid we're supplying to Honduras, stating due to national security interest. What do you know of our plans to beef up a war to overthrow the Sandinista regime?
Well, I haven't, as you know, been in the Senate for a couple of years, so I'm not briefed up to date on all of these things, but what I've been able to ferret out of the things I've read is that we are helping Honduras, and that we're encouraging them to take a very tough line on Nicaragua. Whether we're actually deliberately provoking incursions across the line into Nicaragua from Honduras, I don't know. I haven't been able to find that out. But I worry about it. I think it's not in our interest to encourage these cross-border rivalries in Central America. I concede the fact that the Sandinista government isn't an ideal government. It's not exactly what you would devise in a political science classroom. On the other hand, I understand why it came into power, that you had an impossible tyrant in Somoza who had the backing of the United States for many, many years, and who came to be a very hated figure in Nicaragua, to the point where these young revolutionaries knocked him off and took over the country. That doesn't mean they haven't been guilty of some excesses. I think they have. But neither does it mean that...
The two evils.
Yeah. Absolutely the lesser of two evils, in my view. And that if we had no boycott on Somoza all these years, why should we boycott this revolutionary government that's now in power? I don't think they're controlled by Moscow, but they may become that way if we continue to boycott them and isolate them and cut off commercial and diplomatic contact with them. I don't think we needed to lose Cuba to the Russians. I think it's quite possible that if we had been a little more imaginative and had opened up an embassy down there and encouraged traffic between the two countries, commercial trade, and so it's quite possible that the Cubans, while not presenting the kind of government you or I would like, nonetheless would be a government with which we had some influence. The way it is now, we just give the Russians a monopoly in Cuba, and they exploit it very effectively for their purposes.
Just one more thing. This is on a Reagan newscast that should have taken place. I'd like to read a letter from a typical unemployed American. Dear Dad, due to cutbacks at the ballet. This was Art Buchwald, and I thought it stated a lot.
Thank you.
Senator, returning to the first part of your talk for a minute, I'd just like to know, in your opinion, was anything positive accomplished by Israel's entry into Lebanon?
The there's a kind of an ironic twist to it, in that I think it did a number of things that weren't intended. For one thing, it triggered an enormous peace movement inside Israel. You're talking about 100,000 people being out on the Boston Commons. There were certainly that many in Israel. It tended to focus the attention of the Israelis, who I think, by and large, are a thoughtful, decent people, on what could happen if they relied too heavily on a military approach. I don't have to tell you that no state in the world has 100% military security, including us. We may be the most vulnerable of all to total annihilation. And the Israelis are never going to have total security. I don't care if they take over the West Bank, and Gaza Strip, and Jordan, and Sinai, and the Suez Canal, and the Mediterranean Sea. There's never going to be total security for them or anybody else in the world. So you have to live with a certain amount of danger and a certain amount of insecurity. And I believe a great many people, both in Israel and perhaps in the Palestinian community, now understand better than they did before these bloody ventures this summer that that's not the way to go. And hopefully, counsels of some of the Israeli political figures, Ezra Weissman and Rabin and Abba Iban and Shimon Peres, some of these others who I think are very intelligent, perceptive men, hopefully they will help lead Israel in the direction of some kind of a negotiated compromise on the West Bank, what Mr. Begin calls Judea and Samaria. I think there has to be some kind of a settlement, and what Reagan proposed isn't too bad. It's not an independent Palestinian state, which of course the Palestinians would like, but it does give them some degree of autonomy in federation with Jordan, and Jordan is the home of a great many Palestinians, as you know, and I think it makes a certain amount of sense to federate the West Bank with Jordan, and for that to be successful, the other Arab governments are going to have to give Hussein the chief negotiating role rather than Yasser Arafat. Whether Mr. Arafat will sit still for that, I don't know, but I think what the president has proposed is probably the only thing that the Israelis could ever swallow, and it gives the Palestinians a whale of a lot more than they've got now, or are likely to get. So I think those kind of lessons maybe were sharpened. There's probably no place in the world where there was more anguish over what happened in those refugee camps than there was in Israel. I don't think there's any great rejoicing in Israel that 700 people died in those camps, but it probably had a very sobering experience because it wouldn't have happened had it not been for the war that preceded it in Lebanon. And for their part, I would hope the Lebanese had gotten would get the message too, that killing each other off and the terrorist tendencies of some of the PLO, that doesn't pay off either. They will do a lot better in terms of world opinion if they get out of the terrorism business. I don't know how long we're supposed to go here, Michael.
Well, feel free. You have 6 minutes.
Okay, I'll try to make the answers shorter, but let's just limit it to the people that are on their feet, and I'll make terse answers.
Senator, one of the major complaints many third world nation leaders seem to have about American foreign policy is that they really don't know what it is. That is to say that not only do they get all different sorts of answers from people in State Department, CIA, the Senate, everywhere else, but also that many times large corporations will have more impact and more say-so through bucks on what they should do than what the State Department says. And if they feel they don't get a real message, and even if they try to do what they think America wants to do, they don't meet up with any type of standard because they don't.
Well, I think
no
that's I think that's a valid point, that the American people are frequently in the dark as to where we're going with particular aspects of our foreign policy, and the The other side of that coin is that it leaves other countries in the dark, too. I commend to you an article in the current issue of The Atlantic by George Kennan. And the title of the article is something like this, Our Unpredictable Russian Policy, or Our Unpredictable Soviet Policy. And he traces the zigs and zags in our policy towards the Soviet Union. He points, for example, to the fact that Nixon and Kissinger were carefully laying the groundwork for detente and had worked out a trade agreement with the Soviets, including the prospect of most favored nation treatment. The name's a little misleading. It just means we'd start treating them like we do other countries. But it got knocked off by the Jackson-Vanik Amendment in the United States Senate. I'm free to admit I voted for the Jackson and Vanik Amendment, but it really screwed up American policy with regard to the Soviet Union. I think it confused the American people as to why that trade agreement never came off and why the Soviets didn't seem to pursue it, why the whole thing began to unravel from that that point on. But to whatever extent we're confused on domestic policy, I think you're right, we're even more confused in the foreign policy area. And these special interests that you talk about, the multinationals and others, do frequently have a major impact on our policy with reference to a particular country.
Is there any way to unify? Is there any way to unify the their policy or their direction with what we want our, where we want our country to go?
Well, that's very difficult. I think it's hard in a diverse democratic country like the United States to organize foreign policy in a clear and coherent manner. We've got to try, but it takes a very effective and perceptive leader to do that. I thought that Franklin Roosevelt was the master at that kind of thing, but he had the benefit of wartime patriotism and the fervor associated with that to help him.
I believe that you've already offered at least a partial answer to this question, but I'd like to know under what circumstances, if any, should the United States be willing to extend diplomatic recognition to the PLO?
I would say this, that if the PLO would flat out, no holds barred, just declare that they recognize the existence of the State of Israel and their right to live in peace as an independent state, that under those conditions we could negotiate with the PLO. Doesn't mean you'd recognize them as a state, but it means that you would start negotiating with them.
Yes, in your critique of Reagan's huge defense budget, you limited yourself to nuclear arms. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk about conventional arms, especially in light of the conceivability, at least of this administration, of a limited nuclear war in defending Western Europe, mm-hmm. and also in light of retrospectives on the Cuban Missile Crisis, where it was shown that a fairly strong, or at least a capable, conventional force helped to help us to maneuver a little bit.
Yeah, I wouldn't have any quarrel with upgrading our conventional forces. I think in some cases they need to be modernized. I also think we have a serious problem on the conventional side in that we're losing the best trained technical people who are being picked off by higher paying jobs in civilian enterprises. I've always thought that personnel are at the heart of a good military structure, just like they are at the heart of a good corporation or a good university. And that's where I believe we're the most vulnerable today. It may be true that other countries are having the same problem, but I was at a military base a couple of years ago out in my state, the Ellsworth Air Force Base. It's a big base. They've got 160 Minuteman missiles there and a large B-52 bomber force. In fact, if South Dakota seceded from the Union, we'd be the third nuclear power in the world. But I asked this base commander what his principal worry was. I thought he might say we need to build a B-1 instead of the B-52. He says, well, the problem is we're losing so many of our best trained people. He said, we get a mechanic out here, a crew chief on a B-52 trained with 5 or 6 years experience. They're at the level of a master mechanic, and then they're picked off by Eastern Airlines or somebody else and we lose them. Same thing with navigators, meteorologists, pilots, computer operators. And so I would favor, instead of spending all this money on the MX missile, that kind of stuff, diverting some of that funding to upgrading the pay scales and the incentives for trained people in the military.
Do you agree with Reagan's defense budget with regard to the conventional?
No, I don't. I think it doesn't put enough emphasis on what I've just said. There's very little in there for improving the maintenance of equipment, which is another serious problem. The commander of our naval air operations, his name slips my mind right now, was quoted in the press a while back as saying that 50% of our frontline naval fighters are grounded for mechanical reasons. That's the F-14 Tomcat, which is the frontline Navy fighter plane. Well, if you got half of them on the ground for mechanical reasons, lack of mechanics or lack of spare parts or whatever, that's the equivalent of the Russians having knocked out half the Air Force. And yet we starve the maintenance budget at the Pentagon. It's not very glamorous to go to the Congress and say we need more money to keep these well-trained people and we need more mechanics and we got to get this equipment working and we need better coordination of spare parts and that kind of thing. But I suspect that's where we're most vulnerable. Our personnel aren't always as well trained as they should be. I don't know what happened on that Iranian rescue mission, but it had all the earmarks of a screw-up. In that you had 14 aircraft, six C-130s and eight helicopters, and five of them became inoperational without ever encountering the enemy. You had people falling out of the air and running into each other on the ground and equipment failures. It wasn't all that impossible a flight, but a couple of the pilots who got vertigo hadn't been used to flying in sandstorms. Well, why not? Why do we send people across Iran who are not used to flying in sandstorms? And I think that the mechanical failures on that mission, the pilot errors and all the rest, is very disturbing. I worry a lot more about that than I do the window of vulnerability of our land-based missiles. I wouldn't worry too much if none of those land-based missiles would even fire, as long as we've got the submarines and the bombers and all the rest out there. So, but I think on the conventional side, the Reagan administration hasn't made any improvements over what President Carter had in mind.
Thank you.
Yeah, I believe you've already partially answered this question, but since more and more countries are getting nuclear weapons, something that really scares me is if the very unstable governments in say, Latin America got nuclear weapons, what do you think we should do if, say, someone like Idi Amin got nuclear weapons? And how can we prevent that from happening?
Well, I can't think of anything too extreme to do to Idi Amin if he had nuclear weapons. I'm supposed to be a big dove, but I would volunteer to be a part of the strike force to take him off the scene if he had nuclear weapons. I think though the question is a good one, that the more the Soviets and the Americans lead the way for the rest of the world in the message that the more nuclear weapons the better, the less influence they're going to have in providing leadership on non-proliferation. Until the superpowers get their own arms race under control, they're not going to be very effective in urging the Indians and the Pakistanis not to build a nuclear capability, or the Israelis, or the South Africans, or the Iraqis, or the Syrians, or whoever else is in the business. So that's why I put that first, some kind of an accommodation between Moscow and Washington. But I would hope they and other countries would then press very hard to tighten up on the shipment of nuclear materials so that we could at least lessen the danger that you're talking about. It's bad enough worrying about Brezhnev with missiles, but Idi Amin, that's something else. Okay, this is the last question here.
Senator, the summer issue of Democracy was devoted to a single topic, which was the eclipse of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And a variety of articles were in the issue, basically trying to assess the meaning of sort of the electoral disaster of 1980. And the lead issue was by a political scientist, Walter Dean Burnham, and he looked at the history of the Democratic Party and concluded that the Democratic Party may potentially be in a, may potentially face a long-term reversal of its fortunes and not merely sort of temporary slip. He concluded that the alternatives facing the Democratic Party are basically one, to move in the direction of social democracy,
mm-hmm.
or two, to face a continuing decline of their fortunes. Now, the other articles in the issue were responses to his thesis, and they disagreed on the likelihood of each, whether yeah. one or the other of the alternatives were more likely. Mm-hmm. But they basically agreed with the with his formulation that these were the choices facing the Democratic Party. What do you think?
Well, I did see that issue, and I read Dean Burnham's article. It was a pretty compelling argument, I thought. But my own feeling is that the Democrats are not likely to move in that direction. If you mean by social democracy a socialist economy, you know, along the lines of Sweden or Britain, or even that far. I think what's more likely to happen is that the Democrats may accept the concept of planning, industry government planning, where you would work out an arrangement that instead of just trusting to the free market, which Mr. Reagan, I believe, honestly thinks is going to save us, you would recognize that you can no longer do that, that we have certain industries in decline that are pleading for government investment, government loans, government help, and that until you get some kind of a system to evaluate which industries should be saved, in which areas does the United States have an advantage, where are the economics such that with a little government cooperation and help, we could actually move ahead. Maybe it's in the field of information, data management. Maybe it's in the development of alternative energy strategies. The United States is richly endowed in a whole range of alternative energies. We have about a 500 or 600 year supply of coal. We could be investing more in how you can burn it safely. I think those are the kind of things that, if the Democrats are smart, they will seize on of trying to rebuild the economy along modern lines. But I doubt very much that this country is ready to go the socialist path. I don't think that's going to happen.
Thanks very much, Senator.
I think we have to cut it off, but I do want to. The senator will be here for a moment afterwards.
Well, I think I don't think you have to refer to it as fascism. I think that what you could have, let's just take, for example, the problem of the American railroads, if I can cite one example. It's pretty well known that the American rail system is falling apart. I don't think there's enough private venture capital available to rebuild them. It apparently is not that attractive an investment. But I still think the country needs a modern rail system. Whenever I go to Western Europe, where I was this summer, I'm just appalled at how much better, not appalled, I mean I'm mildly, I'm appalled at what I've left back home on railroads compared to what they have. The same thing in Japan, even the Soviet Union to a certain extent. And it occurs to me that that's the kind of an issue that the Democrats ought to seize on, to say that if we come back to power, instead of building a $100 billion MX missile with federal funds and private contractors, we're going to give America the best rail system in the world. And we'll do part of it with private contracting. We'll do part of it with public service employment. We'll do it any way we can, but we'll plan it. We'll figure out what kind of a rail system the country needs. We won't just say, oh, well, Kalamazoo wants it to run through there, and so the senator from Michigan says it has to go to Kalamazoo. That's what we don't need. What we need is intelligent planning to look at the country's problems and then figure out where is the best areas for public and private investment to do what needs to be done. There was an Sure. The more you can get broad participation, the better. This summer, when I was gone, I picked up an issue in Newsweek magazine. There was a cover story entitled The Decaying of America. And the whole issue was devoted to that problem, the fact that the water systems are inadequate, the sewage systems are obsolete, streets are breaking up in a lot of towns and cities, the ports are inadequate, a whole network of public facilities, most of them are public facilities, they're not privately owned, and they're the kind of things that probably can't be rebuilt by private industry. There's no profit there. And yet, neither private industry nor society can function without them. So we ought to be investing in it. But again, it ought to be done on some kind of a planned basis, not just sort of a hit or miss thing depending on which state has the most political clout in Washington. If I can just take a couple more minutes on this. Out in my part of the country, where we think of ourselves as kind of the breadbasket of the world, and it's really what makes the United States the breadbasket of the world is about 12 inches of topsoil. And that's it. If that blows away or is washed away by water, improper controlled water, then you're not the breadbasket of the world. You're a desert. So I think that the fact that all the big shelter belts that were planted back in the 1930s to stop wind and water erosion, they're now reaching their natural life. They're dying off. That we need to plant millions of new trees across the country, and small water control systems to prevent water erosion. That, again, can't be left to the free market. It'd be nice if it could, if people were just inspired to go out and invest their money in this kind of thing, but that isn't the way it works in the free market. The free market tends to draw the capital to where the biggest buck's going to come in the hurry. And that's why I think that while it's unlikely and maybe not even desirable for us to go into a socialist structure, that you could have considerably more democratic planning as to how we're going to rebuild the structure of the economy, railroad, streets, water systems, waterways, topsoil, alternative energy. None of those things are going to be done by just leaving it to the free market, notwithstanding Mr. Reagan's devotion to the free market. So I hope the next presidential election will be fought out on that issue, on whether you can do it essentially with the free market or whether it's going to take some measure of planning and cooperation with the government and private industry. The other big issue is the one we've been talking about here tonight, our salvation from nuclear annihilation. And those two issues are very closely related. We are not going to really deal with this first agenda of problems here at home as long as this arms race is on. There just isn't enough money in the Treasury to do it. And unfortunately, those arms investments don't produce very many jobs. They used to back in World War I and World War II, but now these new sophisticated systems are so capital intensive and so low on the labor payoff that the more you accelerate the arms race, the higher the unemployment is going to go in the United States. It's not an accident that we have the highest unemployment at the same time we have the biggest defense budget in history. the two are related. Thank you very much.